Next up on This Week in Law, we've got Madonna, Superman, JFK, C.S. Lewis, Aldous Huxley, and some actual panelists, including David Garcia, a researcher on social networks and their resilience, Brad Auerbach, a media and entertainment lawyer, Evan Brown, and me. I told you what we're going to talk about, so just tune in and watch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 237, recorded November 22nd, 2013. Networks of Steel. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Tonks Coffee. Tonks offers a bi-weekly subscription. Tonks sources their beans directly from the growers. They're roasted and shipped within 24 hours, giving you the freshest coffee beans in the world. For a free sample, visit tonks.org/twit. That's tonks.org/twit. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Thanks so much for joining us for This Week in Law. We have a really interesting panel with us today to talk about all the interesting issues at the intersection of technology and law. And as we know, there are always more and more of them. Joining us from Southern California, my neck of the woods, is Brad Auerbach. Hello, Brad.
Greetings. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you very much. Brad, you're a solo practitioner with a lot of background in entertainment and media and also gaming, correct?
That is true.
I started
my career at Disney in-house counsel in the home video group. Then I was at Philips, the Dutch company, a couple other tech companies, Qualcomm and HP, with a bunch of licensing and intellectual property issues throughout all that, and a bunch of clients now in that space.
Wonderful. Well, we're thrilled to have you on the show. You also are acquainted with our intern, San Doe, and have given him lots of help and advice over the years. He's given the show lots of help over the last several months as he's been waiting for his bar results, which he'll get on Friday. So everyone think a good thought for San and everyone else who is out there trying not to go crazy while they're waiting for 6 p.m. Friday to get their bar results. Joining us from Zurich, Switzerland, is David Garcia. David is with the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, known as ETH, and has done some really interesting research on the resilience of social networks. Hello, David.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be in the show.
It's wonderful to meet you. We were talking before the show. David's not a lawyer, and as you probably noticed, the name of the show is This Week in Law. We do try and find and expound on the legal aspects of technology developments. And David's research, his recent research, has had to do with various factors that lead to the demise of social networks. And they've done an interesting case study on Friendster. So I thought it was a good fit, and that despite David's lack of legal credentials, as I mentioned to him before the show, we think that actually helps our guests, that the lack of a law degree doesn't...
I'll do my best,
that doesn't tie them down at all, because we definitely appreciate the perspectives of people who are outside the day-to-day world of practicing or making policy. David's research goes right to the heart of some of the legal issues concerning social networks. They look at the burdens on people that cause them to leave, and a lot of those burdens can have a legal overtone. So we'll get to that in a bit. But first, I want to welcome back to the show, of course, our co-host, Evan Brown from Chicago, Illinois, and the Info Law Group. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. I'm really glad to be spending Friday afternoon talking with you. It should be a great time. That was interesting what you said. The issues at the intersection. There's a lot of alliteration there. So it's there should be a this show should continue in that trend.
All right. We will attempt to keep alliterating. And now I can't, now that I'm trying to do it. So let's move on and look at a big story this week involving LG and privacy. So we have a couple of LG TVs, and it seems that a blogger, Dr. Beat, discovered that there was some data mining going on with his TV, and that his TV was phoning home and sending back information to the mothership, as it were. And this is obviously of great concern. There doesn't seem to have been any disclosure that this would take place. And, you know, viewing data is something that people are rather sensitive about from the privacy standpoint. And LG, now that they have had this problem identified, have admitted that indeed this has been going on. LG claims that no personal data is being collected, but viewing data definitely was, and it says it'll stop. Apparently, this was kind of an oops on the company's part. So, Brad, of course, this kind of story is becoming all too familiar. What do you think of this particular episode?
Well, obviously, it's egregious in terms of what has been disclosed to the consumer, in this case, Zero, and what's been happening with their data. You know, it brings us to mind the case from the Supreme Court nominee, I believe it was, whose video store rentals were discovered and revealed, and that resulted in some litigation. But overall, I think what this shows is a theme that we'll probably be exploring in the next few minutes here and in the weeks and months to come, which is that technology leads and the business model follows, and law tries to catch up. I think that's been evident in a lot of these circumstances. So it'll be very interesting to see what comes of changes in the technology to address this issue so that people are aware that their data is being mined, and then what business model evolves, and then if legislators get up on their back legs and want to drive some legislation through to deal with all this. But I think that third aspect will happen well later, well after the first two things have been looked at.
So, Evan, it looks like the data that was getting sent back included viewing habits, broadcast source, and file names, even when smart features of the smart TVs had been turned off. With no personal data being collected, does LG really have a problem here?
Well, you know, who knows what the real problem is? I think that if there is one, it's going to be whether or not LG was, living up to what its consumers would expect on this. Sure, there was no personal information like names, addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, things that, you know, clearly are PII under any definition of that. But, you know, things like file names, information like that in the aggregate, especially when sent unencrypted like that, can be revealing about somebody. You know, the part that I don't quite get about the story was, you know, one of the examples that the researcher or the guy who was looking into this used, he tested it out by creating a file name called midget porn. So there, that's a provocative way of confirming whether or not there's information that's being sent. So, you know, there's a lot that you could communicate about yourself and, you know, as the case may be, your predilections by just, you know, the information that was made available here. So, you know, things like this, there's really a couple of different layers to this. One is managing the expectations of the consumer, like I'm talking about. But the other message to the consumer is this is just a harbinger of things that are issues that we'll see when it comes to the expansion and the kind of the creeping nature into our local space of the Internet of Things, with more and more things connected to the Internet other than the traditional pieces of hardware, computers, laptops, personal devices. Now, you know, microwaves, toaster ovens, and mousetraps can all be, you know, connected. I don't know about mousetraps, I'm sure at some point, but, you know, can all be connected to the internet. So the more information that is networked, the more likely it is that a picture is going to be, you know, one can paint a picture of the information that's there. So I think the more important point of all this is to be forward-looking and to be proactive as a consumer and as a manufacturer of managing these privacy expectations that will come about in the next few years.
Right. And when you consider this story against the backdrop of the various NSA surveillance stories that have come out in recent months, you can see that having one's television watching you just adds to the data set of possibly obtainable information that it could be just as personal and damaging as email or any other reflection of one's behind closed doors activities. David, I'm imagining that in the EU, this kind of an issue might be an even bigger deal than it is here in the United States.
Well, I guess, I mean, I have no clue about such an event here in the European Union. Mm-hmm. So, of course, there are different regulations in each country. So I guess companies have to be a bit more careful because they just need to control for so many different legal systems and not just one.
Right. And it looks like in this instance, there definitely was something going on that was not taking into account people's privacy expectations or any kind of disclosure even that this was going to take place. Brad, you mentioned this kind of event being the kind of thing that regulators really get behind and use to show their constituents that they're looking out for their interests. Do you have any thoughts or insights as to, you know, is this just going to be one blip on the radar, or is the fact that we have this sort of event happening more and more going to have an impact in Washington?
That's a great question. You know, I think there's as you said, the Internet of Everything has a lot more products coming along. I just read about one yesterday called Nest Protect, and it's from the same guys that brought out a very innovative and well-received thermostat, kind of simplifying that issue, looking at usage patterns and it helping you adjust your usage accordingly. This new product combines a smoke detector and a carbon monoxide detector in one very simple unit. But guess what? It's wired and it's going to monitor and it's going to, you know, feedback information to you. But obviously, this fire hose of data, you know, that is out there, you begin to wonder: A, is it really ever going to be manageable? Who's going to sift through it to do something nefarious or something we hope, you know, productive out of it? And so once legislators get wind of this, presumably from their younger interns, then they decide whether they want to make some political hay out of it by making some noise and showing their constituents that they're, you know, forward-leaning, forward-thinking, et cetera. When and how that may happen in Washington remains to be seen. I think it's really incumbent on the manufacturers, the folks that are in the middle of putting this stuff together, that they take the leading oar and be very consistent and forthright and open about what it is they're doing. And it's very hard because I think, you know, even those of us that went through law school and presumably look at the fine print, how many of us have automatically just kind of clicked through whatever it was they were trying to tell us about their privacy terms, and we just kind of click the box and move on. So it is a very contentious issue, and how we resolve that, I don't know. I do recall, though, one person mentioning that, you know, what it ought to be is that each individual is able to essentially, you know, sell their data, their own data, and that it shouldn't be as freely pulled by folks. So we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, that is a recurring theme. And I think a lot of people are looking at how individuals can control their data and whether they sell it or not, at least dole it out in a way that is user-centric rather than coming from the data gatherers themselves. And I think we have a long way to go before that kind of a system works in the way that consumers would like it to work. On the front of managing privacy expectations, there was an interesting case out of the state of Vermont involving P2P file sharing networks and the data that goes across them. The case was about detection of child pornography. Three defendants were apparently using a P2P network to trade illegal files with one another. And the police plucked that information right off the network using software tools that could, you know, surveil that information, which is, once you're on the network, public, if you know how to watch the traffic. So that's what they were doing. And the defendants argued that there should have been a warrant to obtain the information off the network, that they had some kind of expectation of privacy in that method of transmission. The judge thought no and decided no warrant was necessary, and that what you were doing is making that information publicly available, essentially the same as if you had been posting it on the web. Evan, do you think this is a correct decision?
I'm having a hard time critiquing it too harshly. With this distributed network, you know, like with peer-to-peer file transfers like this, it's that does give us one mechanism to differentiate it from the web. You know, because if it were a subpoena or any kind of investigative activity sent to a web host where there's a centralized place for the data to reside, I mean, it's very clear that that's not something that the law will protect, you know, that the law pertaining to privacy and the Fourth Amendment sense of privacy in this sense, that's not something that will protect. So if there is any area to critique it, it's that these transactions are happening as is obvious here on a peer-to-peer basis. So it's not like the information is quite as publicly declared as what it would be of posting it on a centralized server. But at the same time, I don't see how the information that is being put forth here, broadcast by the peer-to-peer user, is should be given that expectation of privacy because others can see it. It's the same, you know, the law would say that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy when you are talking with someone on the phone. You know, it could turn out that the other person you're talking to is a narc, and you don't have an expectation of that. There's been some cases, at least one that I know of, I'm sure there have been others, where there was no Fourth Amendment expectation of privacy when a defendant's Facebook activity was gathered because the cops had accessed that information using one of the defendant's friends' accounts. So it's, you know, what the law recognizes as the parameters for the expectation of privacy here is, you know, once it's outside of the real confines and out there on the network in any way, absent some other protection, it's public. So, you know, at the end of the analysis, I'm not too surprised about this and can't find anything really to find fault with it.
Brad, do you think that part of the reason for this kind of a decision on a judge's part might be practicality? Because as Evan points out, if you had this sort of information, incriminating information important to a criminal investigation, on some centralized server, then, as Evan said, it's pretty clear you'd need to get a warrant. But here it's the decentralized nature of the data that is leading the judge to conclude that it's public. Does decentralization necessarily imply public? Is this just, you know, an expedient on the judge's part?
I'm with Evan on this. Basically, mm-hmm. I think that the result is good. And I think the somewhat unspoken scenario here is that there's very little argument, I guess, that in this case, the alleged wrong was wrong. You know, child pornography is right up there with whatever the most egregious things are. But that really, fortunately, isn't the standard that should be used, because I often think about this kind of issue in the context of banning books. You know, there's still libraries in the South, for instance, that don't like Wizard of Oz on their public bookshelves or in their school libraries. And I think we could all figure out one book that we'd all agree on is not a good book. We should get rid of that one. But once you start down that slippery slope, you know, you quickly lose any sense of logic. So the fact that they didn't have to rely on this being a child porn case to get to the result, and the fact they looked where you're pointing, which is, you know, the decentralized nature of where the information was disseminated, I think that was crucial to it. And what it's going to drive, which is something we've been reading about in the last few days as well, is a growth in the dark net, this alternate internet that has everything encrypted. There's no way to track who's doing what, and the NSA, who knows, but the NSA is probably trying to figure out how to get inside that to see what is going on. So again, you've got this example where technology is leading and business and whatever kind of transactional thing you're talking about is figuring out some way to deal with it, and the law is creeping up behind.
David, do you have any problem with a judge saying that traffic over a P2P network is public?
I find it pretty reasonable in my point of view. Mm-hmm. When you share something in a peer-to-peer network, you not only share it, but you allow other people to share it too. So it's like a second degree of publicity. It's not only that you let them see it, but you also let them share it with others. So I see it even more public than just a normal website.
All right. Well, let us move on and talk a little bit more in depth about David's research, which has to do with the social web. All right. David, you have published this really interesting paper with some colleagues on the social resilience of online communities and sort of how they live and die based on the costs and benefits to the users in them. Can you, for people who have not seen or read your paper, sort of give us the overview and the context of what you guys discovered?
Yes, so our motivation was to learn how social networks die, or what are the reasons for a collective social network to stop working as a community. And what we did is that we modeled the decisions of users to use or not to use the network, to stay or to drop. And networks are complex systems, so the decision of a user to leave the network might increase the probability that other users also leave the network. So this creates kind of cascades. So what we did is that we took large data sets, including the one from Friendster, that was a very nice example of a dead social network, and we analyzed how these cascades were threatening the network as a whole.
Folks in IRC are asking for a link to your paper, which I'm going to paste in there, but I'll just mention to folks who are not listening to us live that the link to David's paper and everything else we discussed today are in our discussion points that we make available for your public review at your convenience at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/237 for this show. So we've been talking about privacy considerations, David. I know it seems like you guys did not want to go too deep into the causes that make people shy away from social networks, but it seems to me that privacy and the cost-benefit trade-off around it must be a pretty big factor.
I agree. I think threats to privacy from the point of view of a social network increase this cost of users sustaining the network. Mm-hmm. So if you have to decide between choosing two different social networks and one preserves your privacy better, it is trivial that you will choose the one that preserves it better. But the fact that you have more friends in the other might make you choose to sacrifice your privacy instead in the other one. So the key point is the trade-off and how much can this trade-off be pushed, at least from the point of a social network.
Did you discover that that was a factor in Friendster's demise at all?
We would not say that exactly privacy was the factor. I mean, we could mm-hmm. see that there was a sharp change of cost that created a massive cascade, but I would not be able to hypothesize if it's because of privacy or because of some other reason.
Mm-hmm. again, it is hard to just guess about the reasons that users leave, but one of the factors that you've already mentioned is, you know, are your friends there and who else might be there that you might not want to share information with? Again, a privacy consideration. Information keeps coming out and headline-grabbing stories running about Facebook losing younger users who may move on elsewhere, including to companies like Snapchat, which Facebook attempted to buy for quite a lot of money. How do you think young users' attitudes affect the overall resilience of a network?
I see it quite a critical point, because teenagers might get a higher benefit from having many more friends and much more active in the social network. But this is like a double-edged issue, because also they will get more benefits in other social networks. Basically, this is an opportunity cost. A teenager might be using Facebook, but they are losing the time to be using something else like Snapchat or Twitter, anything. So they make them basically less stable, so to speak. They have more time to use everything, but they also want to use more. So in a sense, they are kind of like the very active core of the network, which is also kind of more likely to leave.
So Evan, who's with us today, I don't know if we'd say you're part of a cascade or not, Evan, but privacy certainly was a consideration for you in pulling out of various social platforms that, you know, the ones that you are a frequent and prolific Twitter user, but that one really doesn't have privacy concerns for you, correct?
Right, not as much. And that's just because the information, you know, the complete set of information that's that I would disclose on Twitter is, even if somebody else was gathering that, which I trust probably is happening, I don't mind that occurring. So, you know, a lot of these findings that David is talking about here seem pretty intuitive to me. I guess I'm curious to know, you know, whether or not there would be any analogous principles at work in social networks that don't happen in an online space, because a lot of this seems to be based on pretty sound sociological principles, where, you know, the interactivity or the ability to connect with your friends, it does seem to be the extent to which you can do that, and, you know, there are these core members of the community. It almost sounds the same thing as, you know, cliques in high schools, or, you know, in any kind of, you know, setting where people tend to break off into groups. You know, those networks within networks would seem to disintegrate once, you know, key players and key users go from that. So I'm interested to know how much of this of these findings and these things that we're learning from the autopsy of Friendster, you know, the post-mortem evaluation of it here, how much of that is something that's, you know, purely sociological, and how much of it is something that is particular to the fact that these are online communities? That's something that I'm really interested in knowing about, and taking it more from just more than just the anecdotal evidence that I can bring from my own experiences. David, is that something that you can comment on?
Yes, for sure. So I would say that the main contribution of our paper was not just this decision model. It was the analysis of the complex system as such. So we don't model individual decisions. We basically model the collective decision of a large amount of users to leave. So this is very different from offline communities, because there we have a boundary value for the amount of connections you might have. So we don't have people with 300, 400 people that they keep constant basis communication with on a contact basis with every day, you know. So the point of the online social network is that it might be more resilient, in the sense that these cores are larger and they are more deeply connected, but it also might be more volatile. So in a sense, it is more sensitive to these changes in the cost-to-benefit ratio. So when everything stays the same, it will be more tied together and more sustainable, but then when there's some sort of change, like a platform interface change or some threat to privacy, the reaction might be much larger than it would be in an offline social network. So I would say that yes, there is a categorical difference between what happens in the offline and the online world, but we can still understand it with all these traces like Friendster's.
David, do you use Google Plus?
I did use Google Plus, yes. I had like this automatic account that was created for me because I had a Gmail address. And then I created another professional one, which I expected to use. And no, didn't happen that I use any of them.
Right. What I know that your study focused on Friendster, but what is your take on Google Plus? I've been on it since the beginning, and it seems that it started off with quite a lot of fanfare and popularity, and again, a core group of users who really loved it and seemed to spread it quite well. And then it seems to have undergone a shift where that core group of users at the outset may or may not still be on there. They're probably not using it as much as they used to. But it has spread around the world. And as you mentioned, you know, Google does a very good job of sort of slipping it into people's lives, whereas that, you know, they might not have woken up that morning and thought, gee, I really have to join this network, Google Plus. It just sort of happens to them. So I think that it does have a lot of users and seems to be resilient because it seems to have morphed into something that can be different things for different people. Does that seem accurate to you?
So, well, myself, as a scientist, I try not to really conjecture much about things that I cannot empirically prove. So Google Plus does not let us to download any data, does not release any data, and there are quite a lot of legal constraints for us to analyze it. It's the total opposite as it was with Friendster. So myself, I would say that anything I say falls beyond the realm of science, and it's just a personal feeling. And my personal feeling is that, yeah, I agree. There was a set of core users which took it kind of like LinkedIn, you know, they thought it was more professional. It was more serious to post your papers or your ideas on Google Plus than just your drunk pictures on Facebook. So it created like a different channel, which was more official, so to speak. And that's why maybe got some set of core users that are engaged to this because they have some other motivation, not just social networking, but some other one. And the normal teenagers or people who just don't care so much like me, they simply didn't get hooked on it.
Brad, as far as the big players go, Facebook and Twitter and people who have a lot to lose if they don't have a resilient network, how do you see the legal overtones affecting them? Obviously, they need to attract and find a way to deal with younger users if they're going to survive, and that has legal ramifications both for minors and for those under the age of 13 if they're going to comply with the laws that apply to very young users. And also, of course, on the privacy front for adults. Do you think that these networks are being attentive enough to those considerations to keep their users?
It's a very important concern, and in one sense, I'm right in the middle of it. My daughters are 13 and 15, and the older daughter be allowed to get a Facebook page before she turned the magic age of 13, which was the allowed age, and she managed it maturely, and it was great, and it was fine. Our younger daughter, until she got to that age, wasn't going to have a Facebook page. And we had to watch her a little more closely with regard to how she was handling social media, texting, etc. And the intriguing part here is that the younger daughter really now has no interest in being on Facebook. And I'm sure she's not thinking about privacy issues and the like. It's just something that she's falling away from. You know, maybe as she saw her older sister's experience and the fact that the parents were going to be able to watch what was going to be on Facebook until we said, you know, you're on your own now, which the older daughter hasn't reached that yet. The younger daughter may have said, you know, I don't want mom and dad looking. And I can kind of respect that from a teenager's perspective, but from a parent, you know, it's really incumbent on the parent to get this thing figured out. And that's the hard part, right? because there are a lot of parents that don't understand the nuances of the kind of things we're talking about here and the long-term implications. And they don't understand that the kids could have two Facebook pages, one that the parent sees everything is nice and great, and the other one that the parents don't know about and aren't watching. So you've again got this situation where the technology is out in front of anything that the law, trailing third sort of element here, the law is able to reconcile. So it is something that these companies have to adapt and think about. And I think that they can take the short-term approach of trying to skirt a lot of these issues and try and amass a large audience and then try and be the winner, therefore, in the marketplace with that large engaged user base. Or they could take the higher road, which could be more difficult, in trying to think about all these issues from you know, a legal, moral, ethical standpoint about privacy, as well as what the parental issue is going to be for those that are dealing with it as parents. So it's very complex issues our listeners are discovering.
David, it seems to me like the long tail plays into this somewhere, that large networks that have very large user base and a whole bunch of complicated factors coming into when users come and go are one thing, but the smaller networks that little niches may get drawn off to have an opportunity to thrive here. As do, you know, as Brad was saying, networks that decide to cater to the concerns that may, you know, be causing people trepidation, either whether it's on the privacy front or the child protection front, with some of the bigger ones, you know, you could see that there would be a whole continuum of opportunities for both networks where kids can go and feel like they are not monitored, and then on the other end of the spectrum, networks that parents, you know, can put their foot down and say, if you're going to be online, you're going to be in this controlled environment, you know, and it's either going to be that or nothing. How do you think the long tail plays into this?
I think it's quite a key issue. In fact, I guess that the long tail was quite a factor playing on the social networks before all this fad that we see nowadays with Facebook and so on. The concept of a winner takes all in social networking sites is something pretty new, since we have seen Facebook and Twitter so large. So we have assumed somehow that there has to be some big players or some monopolium, while just 10 years ago we had hundreds of IRC channels and different chats and different fora. So In a sense, maybe we might have a fluctuation that seems to appear that we have some sort of large networks, but they are to some extent unsustainable and they need to just fall apart. And the fringe of the network, or the part that does not stay in resilient parts of it, they will just simply drop and create some smaller subcommunities. The key question is if a large social network is able to cope with this and also create pockets of connectivity in which the users feel safer, for example, more private subgroups or things like that. And to some extent, I don't know if that's happening. I also see that there are smaller networks appearing, trying to basically get this market quota of people dropping from other ones.
Evan, are you frightened about all this as your children approach the age where you're going to have to make the kinds of decisions that Brad is?
Well, I mean, I'm frightened for all kinds of reasons when it comes to raising kids, and I guess this would just be one of them. So, you know, there's with all the expansion of opportunity, there's also an expansion of the ability to kind of keep track of things. It's unlikely that the human attention of one person, you know, one of my kids, would be able to be so out there that and engaged in conduct that I couldn't be aware of. Maybe I'm being naive. Who knows? I'll be the first to admit that I've been naive before on things. But you know, there's still the capacity of one person to engage in a social network from that perspective. But one thing that is really interesting that you brought this up, Denise, is this whole idea of the long tail. And it makes me wonder if the idea of social networking and the impulse for someone to use it, if there's something there that is broader than the whole idea of what could be the activities that are undertaken on old platforms like MySpace and Friendster, new platforms like Facebook. But you look at the phenomenon of Reddit, for example. That is a huge, very active, very vibrant community that has, mm-hmm. you know, plenty of pockets of interactivity in little communities in as much as they form around subreddits. But at the mm-hmm. same time, there's no really kind of ongoing deeper connection that users have with one another. In fact, that's one of the beauties of the site is that, you know, even though you could use the same username for forever on the site, you don't really develop an identity unless somebody really works harder than the average Reddit user to stalk one another as well. So I'm just, you know, I don't have an answer. I don't really know necessarily where this fits into the conversation about what we're observing here and trying to talk about here. But it just goes to this idea of the kind of more of an expansive notion of what a social network really is all about and kind of sets up a new discussion on things like privacy and user identity and the different legal issues that could arise from those. That's just a phenomenon that I'm observing.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Reddit because I sort of see it as the successor to the hundreds or thousands of IRC channels that David brought up a moment ago. And again, Reddit is a very interesting universe because of its sort of free-for-all nature. And you know, it's not gathering a lot of information from users on the one hand, and I think that that's probably very attractive. It's also not controlling what goes on the platform very much, also attractive in a different way. So, David, what do you think about Reddit? And again, you know, I realize this isn't something that you've studied scientifically, but as it sort of sits in the realm of networks, how do you think it fits within your research?
So Reddit particularly I did not study, but I studied datasets mm-hmm. on IRC channels and 4chan that to some extent is very similar to Reddit. And there we could notice that there are two assumptions that we take for granted now in social networks. Usually we assume that we are not anonymous, we have a profile and everybody knows us. And we also assume that everything we write is persistent and can be read later. And what we see in Reddit or in IRC channels is that you don't have this perception of profile and identity. Nobody cares who you are. And also the fact that you comment on something, it disappears very quickly. Even if in Reddit you can see it months later, nobody pays attention to it. So somehow releasing these two constraints is allowing people to just simply lose themselves and take on. So at least in the data from IRC channels, we could see that people were really bonding together, even if they didn't really know each other or if they were mixing a lot with other people. So I see an opportunity there. The problem is monetizing. Then you don't really know how to make money out of users that you don't know who is who and you don't know what to sell them. So that's another problem. But in the sense of interaction and so as a platform, I see it with a big potential.
Right. And then I promised myself I was going to ask you about the well. Did you spend time there and do you have any thoughts on its rise and fall?
On the well? No, mm-hmm. I simply never used it. So
yes, probably before your time.
It could be. Well, I mean, as a teenager, I was quite active already on the internet.
Right.
But still, no, I never used the well.
Okay. Brad, any final thoughts on networks and all of the legal overtones that affect them?
No, you guys have nailed all the issues from where I sit.
All right. Then I think we'll make, let's make brilliant resilience our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Some people out there who listen to the show are lawyers, and many lawyers, particularly in the United States, have to meet continuing legal education requirements. So if you find yourself in that boat and you like to listen to the show, you're in luck because we think you may well be able to get legal education credit for listening to and viewing the show. If you would like to go down that road, we have some information for you on the wiki at wiki.twit.tv. More details there. But we put these phrases in the show in case your monitoring bureau, your state bar, or whatever else you need to report to, wants to be able to see that you actually listen to or watch the show. So we're giving you the opportunity to prove to them that you did, and we're glad that you do. Let's move on to some stories more in Brad's wheelhouse having to do with entertainment. So, Brad, you were on the original board of the E3 conference?
Way back in the day, yes. I was at Philips, general counsel at Philips Media, a division of the Dutch company, and we were doing interactive content. It was early days. It was exciting days. And we had a bunch of things we had to deal with. One was to put together an industry organization that could highlight the business aspects of it. And that was what E3 became, mostly in LA. We were wooed by Atlanta for a lot of different reasons, financial, of course. And in parallel, we also worked on the video game rating system. And that was something that we wanted to take a page from the film industry, which in the 60s, as people may know, was under some scrutiny by, guess who, legislators, the Congress, who felt that Congress would be the best entity to go and regulate and moderate and oversee content for film. And that is something that scared a lot of people. Thank goodness. I don't think that that's the right place for it. And a self-regulating system is what studios did, and that's what we tried to do in the video game ratings effort, and it's been fairly successful in a parallel way. Longer story there, we can get into it, but that was sort of my entree into the E3 and the video game business back in the day.
That's great. So you have been monitoring the development both of how people are given guidance about the content of games and they can make informed decisions for their families, and also what's gone on in the way games are distributed and the kinds of factors that may once have been not as important as they are today, such as DRM. Has it been interesting for you to follow along with companies like Microsoft when they've had to make policy reversals on how they were going to roll out games? I guess at midnight this morning was the first sales of the Xbox One, and that had a whole DRM saga involved.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of stuff in that, right? You've gone from the reality that back in the day, it does make me look old, my gray hair, but back then, the way that you got these games was essentially, you know, in a fixed format on a disc, and everything related to issues like, you know, how big that box was going to be. We called them cereal boxes or air boxes because there wasn't a lot of stuff inside that was important. You just wanted that little disc, but the larger the box was on the shelf, the greater likelihood of consumer awareness, and they would grab that box. Leaving aside the environmental concerns related to that, things have moved obviously rapidly into, you know, much, much smaller packaging, and then now very little packaging, if you will, with the ubiquity of the internet and the ability to get content that way, which led into two directions, something we actually were thinking a lot about but couldn't deliver on because of the technological limitations of not having that kind of ubiquity. What I'm getting at as a casual gamer, and what the video game business has always been very good about doing is showing people, which I think the public at large has accepted, is that it's not just, you know, pimply faced male teenage boys that are gamers. It's really everybody, and it's moms and it's kids and it's the wide range of things. We know that's the case now with the casual gamer. So you've got all that going on. You've got the guys that are building the heavy pieces of hardware, the consoles, as a delivery mechanism, and they've begun to realize quite a while ago that if you're bringing another box into the house, maybe it should be something more than just a single use piece of equipment. Hence, you've got access to a lot of other content that can come through those consoles, making it that much more potentially of a compelling purchase to go along with the games themselves. So tons of issues in and around all that. DRM, I think, is a very important component of it. Going back to what really cratered the music business was the ability for people to start getting music for free. And one particular person that I got to know back in the 90s was speaking in front of a large group of record company executives, and he had a statement that I didn't agree with him on initially, but the more I thought about it, the more I realized he was completely right. So to put it in context, this was about 1994, 1995, I think. And things were going great in the record business. You know, CD sales were were going great, and tens of millions of units sold for the top top sellers. And he sat in front of this group that I was invited to attend, which was a bunch of record company executives. And he said to these guys, he said, look, you guys think you're in the wine business, with the wine being the music, but really you're in the bottling business. What happens when the bottles go away? And they all kind of sat back and said, the bottles won't go away. This, you know, CD business is great. We moved people from, you know, vinyl, let them dabble in cassette, and now they bought it all over again on CD. Things are great. Well, guess what? It was a wine business, and that wine now, then and since then, has become free. So DRM being one particular issue.
Yes, now wine's in boxes, Evan says.
Wines in boxes, yes, yes. But fortunately, they're not air boxes filled with a lot of useless stuff. They're boxed in bottle caps, right, in terms of screwdrivers.
Right. So how do you think the video game industry is dealing with that reality? They, too, are in a wine business, and consumers want their video game wine not in a box, and they want to be able to move it around and use it freely and not have their device phone home like the TVs we were discussing earlier in the day. Do you think that they're ahead of or behind those kinds of considerations?
Well, you raise a couple of points. They're really interesting, and let me sort of grab two of them by way of an answer. One is the idea that I think consumers have gotten to the point where they think, they believe, and I agree with them actually, that once you've bought something, you own it, you should be able to have it across whatever your delivery system is. And I'm thinking first of film. When people buy the DVD, their belief is it should play, you know, everywhere, which is what studios have grappled with, and what they've answered with, as you may know, is ultraviolet. And when you buy a DVD nowadays, you get oftentimes the Blu-ray disc, you'll get a DVD disc, and you'll get the digital rights. And the concept with the third aspect is that you can now take your movie and you put it in a locker in the sky, and it's yours. It's future-proofed in the sense that whatever new technology format comes along, you're able to enjoy that film, Spider-Man, in whatever the content, whatever the hardware piece, whatever the player is about. So if I want to come over to Evan's house and we want to watch my version, because I got the new Spider-Man, and we want to watch one of his players, I can call it up from the locker in the sky, my locker, and play it over his player, as opposed to me having to, you know, bring my DVD or my Blu-ray along with me. So how the video game is going to replicate that and think about doing that is a challenge, because you've got these different formats in the console. And fortunately, back when we were working on the on unifying the format for the DVD, it was the case that we were going to make it the same for everybody, so that the consumer knew if it had the DVD logo, it was going to play on any piece of hardware that also had the DVD logo. When digital streaming of films came along, that was not the case, as we all know. The equivalent would have been a way to describe it, that if digital film was launched in the way that DVD was, in the sense that it was all unified, you wouldn't have had these compatibility problems. But again, back to the hardware manufacturers of the video game consoles, they need to protect their ecosystem, and the compatibility issue is one that you're not going to see, I don't think, anytime soon. But trying to get those video game manufacturers to also think about the casual gamer and how they can enjoy it, it's very difficult. I know that Nintendo has been adamant that any of their characters really will never appear outside of that format, which is why, you know, you don't see Mario elsewhere. One little war story was when I was at Philips, we actually had done a deal where for a brief moment in time, we did have rights to various of the Nintendo characters on the Philips proprietary format that no longer exists. But for those that are rabid collectors, that those pieces of software are pretty interesting to hang on to.
I don't personally think of Ultraviolet as an industry success story at this point, because, I don't know, maybe it will develop into being something that is more widely adopted. But just in my own experience, it just doesn't seem to be helpful, useful, or, you know, the scenario that you played out, I've never had happen in my day-to-day life, where someone comes over to my house and says, oh, I've got, you know, that movie that we all want to watch is one that I have rights to under Ultraviolet, so we can watch it at your house. I just don't think that that people are using the platform enough to make that happen, and that, you know, like, you know, the different formats you were discussing, you've got Amazon, you've got Netflix, you've got all these various other ways that people stream video. And I see Ultraviolet as, you know, again, this is me just sort of anecdotally observing, not being a big player in that game yet. Are you having a different experience, Brad?
No, you raise a very good point. There's no question that Ultraviolet has not gotten the traction in the marketplace, but I would submit that it's a bit of an apples and oranges scenario. When mm-hmm. Ultraviolet was started, it was riding the crest of the amazing success of sell-through in the video business, meaning people were buying a lot of DVDs. You know, before that, people really didn't buy a lot of VHS, other than a lot of Disney titles, which were priced for sell-through. And then towards the end of the VHS era, they started dropping the price. They would sell, you know, VHS copies of League of Legals, Robert Redford movie that you probably wouldn't ever need to own or want to own. But now if you wanted to, it was much more affordable. So fast forward to the DVD and Blu-ray era, set from the beginning to be a sell-through marketplace. And much like the record business, the music business enjoyed the explosion in CD sales, you had the film business being able to replicate that phenomenon through properly priced, well-priced, decently priced DVDs or Blu-rays. And so then you had, what's the next iteration? Well, do we have to have a physical format to enjoy that? Hence the Ultraviolet idea. But what was happening at the same time as that was taking off is you had the ubiquity and the bandwidth being more available for people, and the folks at Netflix figuring out, oh my gosh, we don't have to, you know, ship these discs all around in the red envelopes. What about streaming? And when streaming became available, which is, you know, everything you'd want ostensibly whenever you want, which isn't quite true, but that's the belief that people have. We'll get into that other part in a second. Streaming does resolve a lot of issues, because when you go on to your Netflix list of stuff that you've either set aside for streaming or you just want to go graze, chances are pretty good you will find something you like, and it'll be there. Will it be that new release that you know is available at Redbox or for sale if they're still selling at Best Buy? No, probably not for a while on streaming at either Amazon or Netflix. If you want to get the release, I'm trying to think of what's a current release right now. Some DVD that just came out on Tuesday, people are discovering you won't find it on Netflix for streaming anyway, or Amazon, or anywhere else legitimately. There's all kinds of reasons, the windows of exploitation, the windows of distribution that the studios have guarded voraciously is the reason behind all that. But that said, streaming does take the place for and satisfies me, a lot of other folks, and hence you don't have the purchasing of film in the way that you did before. And Ultraviolet is an effort by the studios, I think a pretty legitimate and bold effort to try and set that up. It's not specific to any ecosystem, and I would say it's really the last best shot at trying to break the hegemony that iTunes has established, which is a closed system. You know, if you're in iTunes and you buy your content there, it works great. It's very elegant, but you can't get out of it. You can't take those films very easily or music selections outside of that without some gymnastics.
Yes, definitely. David, it seems to me that some of this that we've been talking about, the various roadblocks that get put up to people's ability to use media in the way that they would like to, that might play in with your research about networks. Did you find any difference when there were low barriers to entry and exit and moving data around in the way that users might want to? Did that play into the cost-benefit analysis that users went through and contribute to any of the cascades of users leaving?
Yes, well, for the case of Friendster, we might not have seen this particular mm-hmm. dynamics, but for example, we analyzed data from YouTube, and there we could see that if you had these kind of restricting mechanisms, you will not be able to tap into the social capital of the community. Like, these kind of large spreading viral effects will not happen if you have just a little bit below what is the threshold for making something happen in a collective sense. So it is a risk, so to speak, to include this kind of restrictions into how something can be spread, and it is also a chance to explore how much can you get without them, you know. So I mean, myself, I would not really say that in this particular case of DRM and so on will be applicable, but we have some experience in what I'll call network effects. So to some extent, these producers are trying to enforce their technologies and their particular constraints by making people not being able to use anything else. And at the end of the day, we are noticing that this is not working. This is just simply putting barriers and limiting the size of what they can get.
So while we were discussing the various locks and limits on game and video distribution, Beatmaster in IRC was commenting, that's why people torrent things. And I think he's absolutely right. And in response to people torrenting things, of course, they can get sued and can get hit with fines for quite a lot of money. $150,000 plus per violation under the Copyright Act, which, of course, people think might not be proportional or fair. We discussed a few shows ago about the green paper that was authored by our government's Internet Policy Task Force, wants to address that issue of copyright damages and possibly bring the statutory damages more in line with people's expectations for doing this kind of transgression. The MPAA and RIAA have come out with their response to the green paper now, and probably no surprise to folks that they think that the copyright ecosystem as it is doing just fine, that the damages are proportional, and they are a needed deterrent. Essentially, the position they're taking is that, you know, you should trust us. We'll do selective enforcement. You should also trust juries because they can suss this kind of thing out and impose the fines that are appropriate in a given case. Evan, what do you think about the MPAA and RIAA response here?
It should come as no surprise that that's what their response is going to be. So the you know, the real discussion for us to have is, you know, does it make sense, and is there a real problem here that we need to be concerned about if the MPAA is saying those things? And I really see two different contexts for us to have this kind of discussion, or two different scenarios for us to frame and characterize any concern that we would have. The first is in the enforcement actions like the Jamie Thomas case and the Joel Tenenbaum case. You know, is that some kind of public travesty that is brought about because of the availability of statutory damages that we ought to do something about? And, you know, this is where I'm going to just take a moderate position on this. I'm not going to come out and say, oh, you know, Joel Tenenbaum, he's a hero. Jamie Thomas, you know, poor woman, innocent victim. I don't think that's it at all. But I also am not going to say that, you know, I'm not going to laud the efforts of big content in that type of situation. But what I will say is that those are pretty isolated events. You know, there are some pretty, and I'm going to use the people criticize me for this pretty often in comments and stuff, but I want to invoke the doctrine of relative harm here. In the big scheme of things, those are not big problems in our world right now. Two cases like that, and the thousands that have been filed went to trial, and there were big verdicts that were upheld. Okay, fine. That's not a huge scourge on anyone that happens so infrequently. So, you know, given the fact that if in the absence of statutory damages, and I want to just set aside the issue of whether $150,000 is the right number, in the absence of a heavy lever or heavy hammer of statutory damages, whatever the appropriate figure may be, there would be rampant piracy. And, you know, a very small minority of people would agree that that is going to benefit anyone if there is just rampant piracy and that there's no consequence at all for free sharing. We wouldn't have a decent content industry at all, and we wouldn't have the benefits of, you know, the great films that we see in the great video games and other entertainment that we see coming from Hollywood and other big content sources. So that's that. The second context in which to frame any concern that we have here is in copyright trolling, you know, Prenda Law and others. So, you know, that is, again, invoking the doctrine of relative harm here. You know, yes, there were several thousand people who were sued for copyright infringement and had their identities unmasked. And I represent a dozen of those John Doe defendants. But at the same time, it's not a huge issue here. It's a big deal for the people who are sued, but it's not something that's bringing our society and our culture down. I'll say that there are a couple of backstops against that it being too terribly bad. And I guess the better way of saying it is that what I'm really wanting to say here is that the problem of copyright trolling is not nearly as big of a problem as patent trolling is, because for two reasons. One, the cases are going, and I'm just looking at this from a purely utilitarian philosophical standpoint here. I'm disregarding the sensitivities of the individual, but I'm just talking in the abstract here. You've got just individuals being sued for copyright trolling. You don't have whole enterprises who, you know, employ people like Newegg. You know, Newegg doesn't get sued by Prenda Law. It's individuals that got sued by Prenda Law. When you have businesses being sued by patent trolls, you've got innovation at a larger scale being hindered, and you've got companies investing their resources into defending these silly lawsuits that they could be using to develop and innovate and put people to work and all that stuff. The other thing that I would say to make copyright trolling not nearly as bad of a problem as patent trolling is because as it stands now, at least in copyright situations, the loser pays. So sure, a copyright troll can have flimsy allegations, but ultimately if that goes to trial, and I don't know of any Prenda case that went to trial on the merits of the issues of copyright, the loser is going to pay. You know, Prenda Law would have to pay, and Prenda Law has indeed had to pay plenty of the other side's attorney's fees for lots of reasons. In patent law, there's no similar disincentive. And now that I've been talking for however many minutes, I feel like I at some point got on a soapbox. I didn't mean to do that when you asked me the question. But, circling back to what you were saying here about, you know, whether the statutory damages calculus in copyright needs to be corrected, maybe, but certainly not done away with altogether. And we could certainly spend some time thinking about whether that $150,000 is the right spot for it to be set for willful infringement.
Right. I'm not going to try and unpack everything you just said, but one thing that struck me on, thinking about copyright trolls and how we don't need to worry so much about them, perhaps, and the fact that they're not really impacting business concerns yet. I think it's just a matter of time. I think as more and more businesses get into the business of publishing media on their own in various formats, that, you know, they're going to be in the sights as well, just like a business would be in the sights for using technology that may be subject to patents. So I think that one may be right now we're seeing one situation, and a couple of years down the road, I think we might be looking at a completely different kind of scenario. Brad, circling back to you on this, do you have any take on copyright damages and the Green Paper's recommendations and the entertainment industry response?
Yeah, I do have some views on it. And I think Evan hit them pretty much where I would as well. Mm-hmm. Although I've worked at, as I mentioned, three different technology companies, pretty big ones, and the usual challenge is that technology companies, you know, want information and content to be as freely available for their customers, consumers as possible. My heart is really on the content side, not just because I started, as I mentioned, at Disney, but I believe that the creators are what fuels all of this. And with however bright the technology is, bright and shiny the technology is, without the content, everything falls apart. There's a lot of examples where you've got bright, shiny technology, and they didn't go after the content, and you don't really know about this technology anymore. You know, one of them I would propose is the Sony Betamax. It actually was far, far superior to VHS, but the VHS guys figured out that people wanted to see movies, and they figured that out, and that's why we all had VHS back in the day. So thinking about what happens with people that run rampant with other people's rights, other people's creative work, I've talked to a lot of musicians who, and there's exceptions, but there's a lot of musicians that understand that they're doing it because they love it, but it's also their lifeblood. And just as very few of us listening would think about walking into a store, find a store that still sells the CD or even a bookstore and walk out with the item under their coat, the likelihood of them doing that is probably very small. But it's unclear to me, and it's distressing to a lot of people, that that same result is much more easily undertaken when it's done in a digital realm, somehow because there's nothing physical. The feeling is, well, it's not so bad if I just go and watch that film that's just come out on the movie screens a couple of days ago. I really want to watch it. I know where to go find it on the internet, and I'm going to watch it. For that behavior to continue and become ubiquitous, you're not going to be able to find the films later. And you know, people have all kinds of reasons to justify why they do it. They think that it's just a little bit. Why is it going to hurt? It doesn't really matter. You know, I wouldn't have seen that movie anyway in the theater, and all kinds of justifications. But the fact remains is that it's not theirs to take. And whether it takes something like the large kind of penalties that we're seeing as a deterrent, as some kind of mechanism to make people aware that, you know, you could be that student, that little old lady that does get hit with a big fine, and so maybe you want to think twice about it. I frankly like that speed bump in that thought process, that person's analysis of thinking about whether they're going to do this thing or not. Uploading and downloading are two different animals, so there's different ways that folks look at that in terms of setting up penalties. Much as we may have a lot of qualms with the jury system, I think that it is a way to think about and look at the problem, and to rely on the jury to come up with some numbers. We all know the egregious examples, whether it's, you know, tort law or in these kind of copyright law cases or personal injury cases, where the runaway jury, you know, comes up with a ridiculous result. But those are the outliers. Those are why we hear about them. There's cases that go on every day where the result ends up being relatively fair, and other than you know, dipping people in rivers and seeing if they float or not to see if they're guilty of being a witch, you know, I think we've got to think about the system that we've got now is maybe the best ones put together.
Yeah, I have to disagree with both of you on this one. I don't think that as onerous as these penalties are, I don't think they are a deterrent. I don't think people know the penalties are out there. I don't think the average citizen has ever heard of Jamie Thomas, you know, and that the speed bump is just that. It's not a very big one and not a very prominent one. So, you know, if that is the goal, I think it's failing, and that what winds up happening is people who don't deserve to have, you know, their homes and livelihoods destroyed for an act that maybe they were responsible for, maybe they weren't. Still, it's such a small kind of infraction when you look at the grand scheme of how our justice system works and what people can and are punished for. That, you know, I think it's way out of whack and does need to be looked at. And if deterrents are what are needed, then we need more effective ones. And perhaps it's not deterrents that are needed. Perhaps it's a different business model approach. And I come back to David's research on networks and, you know, whether it's effective to lock things down or not. And, you know, my own take on that is that it's not. That, you know, when you consider your younger daughter, Brad, and her ability to go out and have interactions online that are out of your view, perhaps, that the entertainment industry finds itself in that same kind of situation, that's always going to be available to them. And I just don't think that, you know, clamping down with a heavy hand in either instance is probably going to solve the problem. And I think I'll kick this to David to see if he has any thoughts on these kinds of punishments that we're discussing and their effectiveness.
So my take on this kind of measures is that usually they make users think too much. So in general, what we want is people to feel comfortable and to release themselves and just interact in the most human way. So if you are outside in the street and you think you can be held accountant for each and every single word you say, you might not behave the same way as if you are just in a normal setup in which things disappear, words go with wind. So in a sense, this whole monitoring issue is making users be kind of too careful about what they say, I would say. So if you are anonymous, then you are free to say whatever you want. But if you're in a normal social network with your profile and your picture and your address and your IP and so on, then you're simply controlling yourself too much. And at the end of the day, we just have some sort of strange freak show in which everybody is just writing weird stuff. So coming back to the point of the teenagers, I don't really think that making barriers or try to control them is going to be a solution. I mean, I think it is one possible way to approach the problem. And from the fearful point of view, I see it's a good way to do something. But in a sense, they will find a way through. They will have a friend who does not have these limits. They might find some way to connect with another computer or something like that. So maybe it's more a responsible point of view from the educator or the parent to make them think critically about what are these risks, these costs, and these benefits that they get from using an online medium.
Okay, well, this is a heady discussion we've been having, and I for one, could use a coffee break. And if that's something that, and here I even have my little Twit coffee mug to enjoy with our coffee break here. Our coffee break today is going to encourage you to check out a company that you may not be familiar with yet called Tonks. It's a small company made of a tight-knit team of experts who believe that everyone deserves a great cup of coffee and everyone can brew a great cup of coffee right in their kitchen if they have the right beans. And it all starts with quality, fresh roasted beans. That's why Tonks sources their beans directly from the growers, roasts them, and ships them within 24 hours of roasting for the freshest beans you can find. So I really like this idea. I've become more and more the person who does not have time to spend time in grocery stores and running around trying to get all the food and household items that we need to have on hand on a daily basis. And Tonks fits right in with that. It's a bi-weekly subscription that sends you the best beans on earth directly to your door for the price of a few cafe visits. So that kind of thing in my life is incredibly important, and I'm hoping that it is for you guys too. And of course, the other factor here to consider is not just the convenience, but the real wonderful coffee that you're going to get. It's going to be just as good as your favorite cafe. It's not as hard as baristas to make a good, not as hard as baristas make it out to be to make a good cup of coffee, but you have to have the good fresh beans to do it. You can't get that if you just buy beans from the grocery store, which I don't want to spend any time in anyway. So pre-ground coffee is even worse. Great coffee actually has very little to do with fancy gadgets and expensive gizmos and has everything to do with the good coffee. Tonks offers plenty of help on the best brewing methods and equipment, and it cares about the experience of its customers. They're available to help with any brewing questions that you might have and offer tips and advice. It's Tonks Coffee on Twitter and also at Tonks on Twitter. A great way to find out more about the company and to interact with them. If you fancy yourself a coffee connoisseur or just love coffee, you need to try Tonks Coffee. These guys are fanatical about delivering the best beans in the world, and they source directly from the growers, roast and ship it within 24 hours, so it's as fresh as it can be. Every 2 weeks, you get a new batch of incredible beans roasted to perfection. It's subscription only, and they're offering a free sample of coffee to our listeners. What could be better than that? To get that, go ahead and go to tonks.org/twit. Get some of their coffee for yourself or send it to someone you know who appreciates the finer things in life. Visit tonks.org/twit today. Thank you so much, Tonks Coffee, for this coffee break during This Week in Law and for sponsoring the show. All right. A couple of other entertainment stories I think we can wrap up with, a little bit more lighthearted and easier to digest than how we're going to revamp the whole copyright damages system, if in fact that's what's going to happen. Story about Madonna and Vogue. I always think music sampling lawsuits are interesting because it's hard to pin down, as it was in this particular case, whether sampling even occurred in some instances. Here, it's almost like they were the plaintiff in the case was arguing that the sampling occurred. I don't know if you ever saw or read Carl Sagan's Contact or saw the movie, but the message there occurred in various layers. And here the sampling, it seems, was the plaintiffs were arguing. You might not have heard it in the recording, but it was there. They used technology to unearth the fact that some of their song called Love Break was deliberately hidden in the song. This didn't fly very well with U.S. District Judge Beverly O'Connell. She kind of dodged the important issue of whether a very brief sample could ever amount to copyright infringement. But she did find that what happened here was not that. So, Brad, I thought this would be an interesting case for you to discuss with us. Do you think Madonna got away with something here, or that this came out correctly?
It feels like a correct result. You know, there's a whole bunch of these types of cases. The one that really caught my eye early on was when one of my heroes, George Harrison, was brought to trial. His song My Sweet Lord was alleged to be infringing on a song called He's So Fine. And the judge, whether he was a Beatles fan or otherwise, kind of split the baby and came up with this idea of unconscious infringement. There was no question that Harrison had heard that song or would have heard that song, and it may have influenced the way he set up his chord structures and all that kind of thing. But in this particular case, the idea that someone's riff, as short and concise as it may have been, was sort of buried in the layers of the production and therefore was infringing seems to be a little egregious. And I think the law in a lot of cases steps back and takes a common sense approach and thinks about, you know, consumer confusion, which isn't really the standard of review in a copyright infringement case, but it is somewhat relevant in my mind anyway, because consumer confusion is what protects you from copyrighted work. And if someone thinks it's yours or you're associated with it, you know, whether it's an example of a dry cleaner opening up and calling it In-N-Out dry cleaning, you somehow believe that's part of In-N-Out Burger, which folks here in Southern California and the West will know about. You know, that consumer confusion idea is a relevant standard, I think, here. And the judge seemed to go down that road and coming up with the conclusion that Madonna wasn't amping and infringing here.
Right. And I like the fact that the judge seems to have recognized that in order for there to be any harm, the person listening would have to actually recognize the alleged clip that led to the infringement. And that doesn't seem to have even been a factor here with the way that the clip was supposedly hidden in the song. Evan, do you agree that, you know, at least you should be able to detect that there is some trace of another work in a song if there's going to be sampling infringement?
I think that's really the key issue here, because what the judge relied on was this idea that it was de minimis. And, you know, this concept of de minimis use is sort of a first cousin to fair use. It's not exactly the same, but if you break down the analysis for a de minimis defense in a copyright infringement matter, it's that such a small portion was used or is used in such a way that there is no longer any substantial similarity, which is really the touchstone portion of the analysis on that here. And I think that this could have interesting implications if courts were uniform in applying the de minimis doctrine here uniformly. I think it could have some interesting implications in all kinds of different iterations of remix culture. This was a music case, so the sample was taken and it was used and it was twisted and it was modified in a way that made it imperceptible for 20-some years. I mean, Madonna's Vogue came out in 1990, so one of the more one of the first things that come to somebody's mind when reading about this case is, my gosh, why are we, having copyright litigation over a song that's almost 25 years old? But this could have implications in other media as well. The graphic arts, you could take an image and so distort it and change it up so that it even goes beyond the question of whether it's a fair use. If the object of the use has changed so much that it no longer is the same object as the original work, you take that and extend that so much that it could be a de minimis use where there is no longer any substantial similarity. So the decision, I think, is very sound when it comes to copyright law, and it does nothing to hamper or inhibit the rights of the copyright owner, because it's just it just makes good sense. It doesn't a decision the other way would have done nothing to remedy any harm whatsoever to the copyright owner in this situation. So I'm perfectly comfortable with the court's decision.
All right, let's end the show with a couple of stories involving very well-known figures and whether or not the rights to using those well-known figures are securely in the hands of the people who think they have them. Brad, it looks like Warner Brothers finally is the clear-cut owner of Superman and everything related to it. We have been seeing recently how important it is for your former employer, Disney, to be able to use and leverage its Marvel franchise in various ways. So I'm sure this is important to the folks at Warner to have this put to rest. Can you tell us why there was a dispute?
There's a very interesting history about Superman, and I encourage folks to poke around. Particularly, there's a great podcast called Studio 360, and they have within that an American Icon series. And I heard this particular one about Superman a couple months ago, and I'm not a big fanboy or comic book fan per se. I didn't know this history, certainly, that Superman was started back right before World War II, a couple of Jewish creative folks in New York came up with it, and it was sort of their way to think about fighting evil and kind of making it an everyman story. So it has a very interesting backstory, if you will, and then how it's evolved through the television show that I grew up with, and then the films that got a little campy, as these things tend to, and then the rebooting that recently happened. So, a tough result if you're the family member and if you didn't have decent legal representation so to protect yourself along the way. But to kind of come in at this stage, much like we were saying before about the Madonna situation, and hope to get some compensation. It does, like I said, make for a hard story in that sense, but something that seems like the right result. And you mentioned Disney, and it's kind of funny because if you look at where they got their start, they were not very original. Those early animated films were Grimm's fairy tales, kind of polished and sanded down and made warm and fuzzy and very successful. In fact, if you go way back to the very first animated project that Walt worked on, called Steamboat Willie, there's very good evidence that that's actually taken from some existing storylines that were out there. And so whether it was something that he created from whole cloth, it doesn't seem quite clear. So, the history of these kinds of things are fraught with a lot of intriguing backstories and a lot of convoluted ways that the rights end up settling down. And like it or not, lawyers seem to be right in the middle of it. So I put this in the category of the Lawyers' Full Employment Act.
Right. And the complexities of fair use, too, which also come into play with something, Evan, you posted about just this morning on the anniversary of the death of Aldous Huxley and C.S. Lewis and John F. Kennedy.
That's right. That's right. I was wondering, you know, how it could tie the, you know, JFK assassination into technology law and wasn't quite able to do that. But at least there's a copyright angle we can take to this. The Zapruder film, you know, and we could also talk about kind of, you know, how the world has changed. Had there been the public murder of a president, there would be, you know, thousands of photos from our smartphones and, you know, live video and everything else. But, you know, Abraham Zapruder was the, you know, was filming the motorcade pass by with his 8mm camera back in 1963. And so just a couple of days after the assassination, Life magazine bought the copyright in that film and made a few still frame images from it. And they were very important in the Warren Commission's investigation of the assassination and all that. But in 1967, an author by the name of Thompson wrote a book about the assassination, and I believe it had to do with some conspiracy theories already. Even, well, you know, there have been notions of conspiracy theories all along, but he couldn't. The author could not get a license from Life magazine to use those images from the Zapruder film, so he hired an artist to make charcoal sketches that copied, slavishly copied the images from the Zapruder film. Long story short, Life sued for copyright infringement, and there were a number of interesting issues that came up out of that. The first one was on the question of originality, you know, whether or not the film was subject to copyright protection at all, and the court held that it was. And that really is no surprise. You know, back as early as 1880, we knew that photographs were protectable by copyright, and they'd been protected under the copyright by statute since the Lincoln administration. So there was the court said some interesting things. This was the District Court of New York. I guess it was before New York was divided up into different districts, but this is the District Court of New York in 1968 opinion held that, you know, the way that the camera was and the lighting and things like that was original, and that Zapruder's work was original, creative enough to be protected by copyright. But then there was this interesting fair use analysis as well, because the defendants said, hey, even though this is protected by copyright, Thompson's use in the book should be a protected fair use. And remember, I said this was 1968, and Section 107 of the Copyright Act wasn't, you know, made part of the Copyright Act until effective January 1st, 1978, and the Copyright Act of 1976. So it's interesting that the court, the District Court of New York, looked at the same four fair use factors that we find now at Section 107, because at that point it was in a House bill that had been passed but had not been taken up by the Senate. So there was just a pending bill before Congress that had what is now Section 107 in it. It didn't become law, of course, until several congressional sessions later. But long story short, the court – actually, it's a long story long by this point I've been talking about. the court found that it was a protected fair use, and there was some really interesting discussion by the court. Even though this was 1968, it could be very well, you could very well find it in a judicial opinion of modern vintage. In fact, the court said something very similar just last week in the Google book search case that, you know, come on here, plaintiffs, what are you so concerned about? This work actually could help you raise interest in the original underlying work, this case being the Zapruder film. It didn't do anything to, you know, negatively affect your market. It actually would be a benefit to you. So the court found that it was a protected fair use. So there you have, arising out of the Kennedy assassination and the Zapruder film, an interesting case that unfolded over the next few years about copyright, originality, and the very important issue of fair use. So something quite apropos for us who are enthusiastic about these things to be commemorating this 50th anniversary with that. So I leave you with that information.
So we'll make Zapruder the second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Evan, I was curious if I didn't go back and read the decision, if the transformative nature of the use, since they did drawings, played into the fair use analysis.
Didn't really talk about that. I mean, the court did away with the fair use analysis quite a bit, and it was mainly about the fact that people didn't buy the book for the purposes of seeing the pictures, which really I don't even know which of the four fair use factors that comes under. I think it's probably effect on the market. But even more, and so that was one part of it. You know, they didn't do a nice systematic, you know, section of the opinion for each of the four fair use factors. So, but there was that. And then there was this also, and I actually pulled up my blog post that I wrote about it earlier today. Go to internetcases.com to read about that. The last sentence of my post is pulled from the opinion. It says, it seems more reasonable to speculate that the book would, if anything, enhance the value of the copyrighted work. It is difficult to see any decrease in its value. I mean, that's a sensibility that people raise all the time now, saying, why is big content so upset about piracy? It's actually raising awareness. That whole idea is not new. It was out in 1968 as well.
Yeah, it's funny. You're juxtaposing the Zapruder film with all the technology we have today. The Zapruder film, when it's run, is so often put on a loop that I sort of think of it as the original Vine. You know, where you're watching the shot over and over again.
Yeah. And so, stills, you know, certainly have that Instagrammy filter kind of suave to them.
So everything old is new again. We have a resource and a tip for you. Our tip I've dubbed Mind the Apps. And that is because there is a study out that says that more than 1% of Google Play apps are copycats of another kind of app, you know, a Facebook or a Twitter app, but they're kind of insidiously, again, back to our LGTV story and discussion, doing things you don't want them to do. They may, you know, add pretty colors or other things that might say, you know, hey, download this instead of the official Facebook app, et cetera, because, you know, we've customized it. We've made it cool for you in some way. But in the background, they're doing some things that are not so nice, such as sending data about your phone usage to places that you may not want it. So do mind the apps for these Google Play Store copycat apps that are masquerading as the originals. My first experience with the Google Play Store was this week. I'm setting up an Android phone for the first time for my son, which has, as we were discussing with kids' social network use, kids' phone use has its whole raft of issues and concerns, both parental and legal. But one of the things I noticed in using the Google Play Store is that unlike in the iTunes world, when you download an app from the Google Play Store, you get a whole bunch of information about what the app can do and access. And sadly, Brad, you were alluding to people just sort of clicking through all that stuff, even though consumers are provided with this information, and some of it can be fairly sobering. I think the probably most common reaction is just to go, okay, I want the app, so I'm going to go ahead and click okay. But it's nice that in that universe, there is a bit more disclosure going on. But apparently, you're only able to learn things about the apps that are disclosed to the Google Play Store. And if people want to be nefarious about things, then you're not going to get that kind of information on download. So be careful about copycat apps in the Google Play Store. And then our resource of the week is an Indiegogo project to go check out. It's called Ghosts, and it's a web app game. And what it does is it takes digital trackers, the things that record your online presence, behavior, and interests swarming around the web, hidden in code and invisible. And in this game, it identifies those kinds of trackers and turns them into ghosts. And you see analytics, advertisers, widgets, and beacons all take shape. You, as a knight as in the game, get to fight them off until they're all gone. So it's another way of exposing privacy issues and letting people know about the trackers that are out there, and also kind of fun and funny to take these things that are supposed to be stealthy and turn them into a little game for your entertainment. So go check out Ghosts. It's a neat kind of a project, kind of in keeping with the issues and things that we follow on the show. And with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. It has been great fun chatting with you guys today. David, thank you so much for staying up late in Zurich. We really enjoyed your insights, and your research is fascinating. And why don't you tell us, now that you've done your Friendster study, what else is on your agenda?
So currently I'm working on studying polarization of opinions in online communities. So how early interaction creates disagreement in a later stage of some community. And also, to some extent, we are dealing a bit with how information spreads through users. So in a sense, all these privacy leaks are a way of information spread. So in a sense, we are getting closer to all these issues because it's a hot topic. And well, it's been a pleasure. And thanks a lot for the opportunity to talk.
Yes, great meeting you, and we really appreciate your taking the time. Brad, you as well, wonderful getting you on the show, and we loved your insights and perspective and war stories.
Thanks, I enjoyed it also. Some thoughtful discussions, some good dialogue here, and I was pleased to be a part of it. Thanks for asking.
Our pleasure. Evan, great to chat with you, as always, at the end of the week. Wouldn't be Friday without you.
I hear you. Yeah, the same. Really enjoyed our conversation. Brad, very nice to meet you. Interesting to learn about your practice. And David, really neat to hear about your research. Enjoyed talking with you as well. So Denise, always fun. So looking forward to. Oh wait, not next week, right? Thanksgiving.
That's right.
Don't we have next week off? So
we do. We are going to be digesting our turkey on Friday, and we encourage you to do the same. We're taking a break from doing the show next week. But we'll be back with you. I guess it'll be the first week of December already by then. So definitely enjoy yourselves. Maybe cruise back through the Twill archives if you find yourself next Friday morning needing to get your fix of Twill. You can find them at twit.tv/TWIL or on YouTube at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. We're in iTunes and on Roku and in various other spots, however you like to get this kind of information and entertainment. The twit.tv iPad app is a great way to go and allows you to use the IRC chat while you're watching things. I always enjoy that too. If you're a fan of lots of shows on the network or maybe just this one, we want to hear from you. It's that time of year. We have a survey that we'd love for you to participate in. It's at twit.tv/survey. Let us know what you think. It really only takes a few minutes. It's completely anonymous. Nobody's going to be gathering your information and sending it off anywhere. But your feedback is enormously helpful to us. It will help us make Twit even better. We thank you for your continued support of this show and all the shows. And we really hope that you'll take the time to tell us what's working and what's not and what you'd like to see and hear more of. So we will be back at our regular time at the week after Thanksgiving. That's Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC this time of year. We record live at that time at twit.tv. So we hope to see you there. Jump in IRC with us if you can while you listen live. And don't forget to check out the discussion points for this and all the shows at our Delicious account, which is delicious.com/thisweekinlaw. And if you'd like to chat with us about in person directly about what went right and wrong with the shows and things you'd like to hear about, hit us up on Twitter. I'm D Howell there. Evan is Internet Cases there. Head on over to our Facebook or Google Plus page or send us an email. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. So however you get in touch with us, get in touch because, you know, without you guys, there is no show. We do it for you, and we love hearing from you about what's interesting and what you'd like to hear us unpack a little further. So with that, have a happy Thanksgiving, happy holiday, everyone, for if you're in a country that celebrates next week as we do here in the U.S. If not, have a brilliant week anyway, and we will see you the next time we record the show. Take care.